Welcome to Open Studio, where we put a spotlight on the arts, artists, and issues in the cultural community. I'm Tom Musgrave. Dr. Jefferson Johnson joined the University of Kentucky School of Music faculty in 1993, and his career has positively impacted not just the campus, but the Lexington community at large. He announced his retirement this year and conducted his final concert as UK's Director of Choral Activities April 24th. We've invited him on the program to talk about his career, what drives him as a musician, and to reflect on his time as a music educator. So welcome, Jeff.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I do want to time travel back to 1993 in just a moment, but first I want to congratulate you on what has to be a full and rich tenure here at UK. We're recording this in mid-April, so the concert that I mentioned in the introduction hasn't happened yet, but how does it feel approaching this closing of a chapter for you?
Well, I mean, it's a book. So I've had several chapters, but this is, we're closing the book on this one.
I like to think you've got some more chapters there, in
well, you. Well, I think I'll maybe write a new book.
Okay.
I'll write a new book and maybe a little smaller little novelettes or something, you know. But it feels, honestly, there are a lot of mixed emotions. And those are sometimes even extreme. Like I'm very excited for the future of the program. That I'm leaving it in really good shape. Our choir program at UK. I feel like I can say that. So I'm excited for that. I'm excited for the kids that are coming back into the program and the ones that are yet to come into the program and kids that are out there that haven't even thought about, you know, college yet, but they will end up, some of them, in the UK choirs. So I'm excited about that. But the other side of the coin is not sadness, and it's certainly not regret, because this was my decision, and I thought a whole lot about it. But there's just that tinge of, I'm going to miss this like crazy. Because I've done it for so long, and it's been a real part of who I feel like I am. So, I'm giving up. I feel like there's going to be a sense of loss, I think.
It's not like I don't want to say ordinary job, but it is. You're getting essentially a new set of coworkers every year, and you're starting out each semester and you're building. It's a cumulative thing, and so that I can certainly see missing something like that.
The other thing that's a little different about my job as choir director at the university is that I have students for 4 years. You know, an accounting professor has them for one semester, and so I get to know them maybe a little better, and they get to know me a little better, and our lives intertwine on a more deeper level than we might if we were only briefly, you know, in contact. So this sense of ownership in the program is a little greater, perhaps the sense of responsibility for the kids and how well they do in my class, but also in life. There's the affinity that I have for them is, I don't know, I won't say it's greater than any other professor, but it certainly is great.
And I do want to get into that relationship with this, especially the distinct possibility that there's a multi-generational situation that you've encountered. But for now, take us back to 1993. When Jeff Johnson has arrived in Lexington, what was Jeff like back then? What was the College of Fine Arts and the School of Music like back then?
My wife and I came down. We'd been married 1 year, and we came down from Michigan State. I was a junior professor at Michigan State University, and I knew that this would be a huge promotion for me to be a director of choral activities for the first time at a major state university. And even though the program at Michigan State was very, very strong, mm-hmm. choral program, I was not in charge of it. And I was felt like a postdoc experience for me, because I was right out of my doctorate then and very green. So when I came here in 93, I was still learning the job, still learning how to do things. But I got to... I was fortunate enough to inherit a program that was ripe for growth. and building. We didn't have a whole lot of students involved in the program at the time, and so there was this rich, potential that I saw in the program. I thought, well, this is, and I remember telling my wife this after I interviewed. I said, honey, this is a sleeping giant, and we just need to wake it up. Mm. And it's going to take some time. And it did. It took some time, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. But, gosh, it's been so rewarding to see it grow year after year.
Yeah. You've introduced things like the holiday collage program that have become so kind of intertwined in the community around the holiday season. What and we've talked a little bit in the past about your involvement in that, and especially the multi-generational aspect of that too. Mm-hmm. So, how does it make you feel to kind of hand that off?
Well, the collage started out as a Christmas concert. That's all it was a Christmas concert. Every choir does a holiday or Christmas concert. Every choir. Church choirs do, Advent cantatas, their version, mm-hmm. or something of the sort. But every school choir, in America does a holiday concert, a concert around the season of Christmas, with a theme of Christmas music, basically, and holiday music. And ours was no different, except that we had the idea of let's not let people clap in between numbers. Mm-hmm. Let's make it so fast-paced that they have to hold their applause, and we ask them to hold their applause until the end of each half. So that made it a little different from the start, and it gave it a little kind of a different energy, I think, the concert. The other thing we decided to do was to involve as many diverse musical groups as we could within the university and within the community. So we have everything from, classical choral singing to organ solos to, classical guitar, steel drum band, bluegrass. Bluegrass is about as far from classical choral singing as you can get.
And I remember you had klezmer one year, too.
We did. We've had klezmer. Yeah, it's been, pretty much we opened our mind. I mean, a lot of African drumming influence mm-hmm. in the concert. We opened our minds to what would be possible and fit those different that variety of musical styles into this tapestry or collage, if you will, of with no applause. Mm-hmm. So the combination of those two things, I think, made it sort of enticing or different or unusual or fun for the audience. But I would have never in a million years guessed that it would have taken off like it has. And it's been so rewarding to see the growth in that event. We've now sell out. We went from the one performance at Singletary to three now, and we could easily, audience-wise, we could expand to more performances, but we would be taxing the kids, I think, to a point where they might not benefit from it. So we'll probably cap it at three, I don't know. I don't know what will happen in the future. We capped it at three performances while I was there, but we sold them out so quickly. Nowadays, we've been selling them out lately in late October, early November, so a month out.
Yeah. Well, and I think to your credit, the audience is well trained now not to applaud between the.
That's right.
They, as the kids say, they understand the assignment when they come in. So it's nice when you've got an audience who so respects the program and has been coming back. I imagine like year after year that they know what to expect, and
we get a lot of repeats. Yep, a lot of repeaters.
So yeah. I want to I think. I'm not going to say the names because I think I know them, but I want to let you say them. Who have been some of your influences throughout your career as a musician and music educator?
Well, so that in the big picture, growing up in Atlanta, I would first have to say Robert Shaw, who was in the 20th century. He was known as the preeminent choral composer, probably in the world. Certainly in America. I say that with zero prejudice, because it's pretty much universally understood in the previous century. So Robert Shaw was the conductor of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra and chorus. I was a member of the chorus, and at one point I was 17 years old. I was the youngest member of the chorus. I had no business making that, passing that audition, but somehow I did. And I was a college freshman. I have a late birthday. So I was a college freshman at the University of Georgia, driving back to Atlanta from Athens, Georgia, every Monday night for rehearsals. And I kept that up for most of that first year, and then it got to be too much. But even after that, when I went back and I graduated from the University of Georgia with a degree in choral music education, then I got a high school teaching job in Atlanta, and that made it a lot easier for me to free up my Monday nights and just, you know, drive downtown to Atlanta, to downtown Atlanta from Avondale or Marietta, whichever school system I was teaching at, and sing with Robert Shaw. So Robert Shaw has to be one of the ones.
So did you audition for Robert Shaw when?
No, Robert Shaw doesn't sit in on the other. He has a panel of folks, and they sit behind a screen. It's like orchestra auditions. They're mm-hmm. blind, yeah. In quotes. It was very intimidating, super intimidating.
I imagine. But I guess if you knew he was in the room too, that probably would have like doubled the factor.
Well, I'll tell you, once you got in the choir, if you made it into the choir, then that also, every Monday night, it was, even though it was a large choir, 200 voices, he had ears like a bat. That man could hear. If you sang out of time or out of tune, he knew it. And he would look in your direction, and he would make a stern comment. he was a real taskmaster, but oh my gosh, what a musician that man was.
Well, I will, in the interest of full disclosure, I sing in Jeff's other passion project in Lexington, the Lexington Singers, mm-hmm. and his anecdotes about Robert Shaw come up every season, and never unwelcome, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
So we mentioned it earlier, but how often has it happened that you have taught someone and then maybe 20 years later you're teaching their kids?
Well, this is another thing that I would have never, ever guessed would ever happen to me or for me, but it has repeatedly now. So when I got here to UK, we had to I knew we needed to build the music education part of our program. You know, right off the bat, we needed to start teaching students how to teach. Then we needed to graduate them and get them jobs. And then they needed to be successful at their jobs, and we needed to help them do that in any way we could, providing resources, going out to visit and clinic with them, whatever, loaning them music, whatever we needed to do, having them over to be guest choirs on our campus. And then at some point, they get good enough to inspire their students, their high school students, to want to be music educators. We talk them into coming to the University of Kentucky. They come into our program. They go through our program. And so then I have students of students, former students. Mm-hmm. My choral grandkids. After I retire, maybe I'll sit down and count. But then, Tom, what happened was I stayed long enough, and I don't know how this happened, but I stayed long enough so that those grand students graduated, got jobs teaching music, taught their students, sent them to the University of Kentucky, and boom, then I have choral great grandchildren.
Yeah. So that's quite a multi-generational. Are there any instances where students you've had, their actual children have then come to UK,
yes.
and then become music educators? So you've got a multi-generational music education,
yes.
family?
We have several of those.
Wow.
We have several students whose children, actual children, biological children, have come and been our students.
That is a sobering realization.
I know. Tell me.
So for your final concert, you have programmed Johann Brahms' German Requiem.
Yeah.
And we've talked outside of the context of this interview about the significance of that piece to you. And I learned a bit of Jeff Johnson trivia related to the Requiem. You said it was your first piece, the first major work you had ever conducted here at UK, mm-hmm. and you planned on it being your last. Mm-hmm. When did you know it was going to be your last?
Well,
how long ago, I guess.
Right. Well, probably maybe, 30 or 40 years ago, even before I came to the university, the Brahms Requiem has a reputation of being sort of the ultimate choral orchestral experience as a choral singer and a choral director. For the orchestral players, I don't know, there may be other pieces that are more, like maybe the Mahler Second is something that's more rewarding for them to play. I don't know. But for a singer, the Brahms Requiem is pretty much it. So it's logical from a choral conducting point of view to want to start with it and end with it. And so that's what I've done.
So, what is it? Does it have an extreme? I mean, other than being the first major work that you conducted here at UK, musically, academically, scholarly, what is it about the piece that keeps you coming back to
right,
it?
Right, right. No, it's a good question. The Brahms musical language, harmonic language, melodic language, his compositional techniques, and we're talking 1800s Germany. So he wasn't the only great composer at that time. He's surrounded by Schubert, Schumann, Mendelssohn. I mean, he's Wagner, all in the same geographic area and the same time frame, same generation, and Beethoven just barely before him. Brahms his music is difficult but beautiful, and you and I could sit here and name a lot of composers whose music is difficult but maybe not as beautiful, and we could name composers whose music is beautiful but maybe not as challenging or has as much depth as Brahms. So he's got all of that. He's got the whole enchilada. And the amount of choral singing in the Brahms is surpasses most choral orchestral works. Many works like, Beethoven Ninth Symphony. Beethoven, three quarters of that is only the symphony, the orchestra, and the chorus comes in the fourth movement. With the Brahms Requiem, chorus comes in after about 16 bars and then stays in pretty much for the next hour.
Yeah. And it also is fairly... radical for the time in that Brahms chose to set it in German as opposed to Latin.
Yeah, it was groundbreaking, and in some senses still is a very surprising work. So for centuries, the Requiem, which is a mass for the dead in the Catholic Church, it's been that way since, maybe 500 AD or earlier. The words haven't changed in the Latin version of the Requiem. The words have remained the same century after century after century. So for someone in 1868 to say, I'm going to change the Latin, instead of saying the Latin Requiem, let's sing it in my language, German. But that's what he did. And so he chose passages from the Lutheran Bible instead of the Latin liturgy, and then took some Psalms as well and pieced together a very eclectic, for the time it was very eclectic text about not only blessed are the dead, which is the basic kind of thesis statement of the Latin Requiems, but this is blessed are the living.
Mm-hmm. And that sort of takes it, it makes a little more whole, makes the experience a little more whole.
Certainly more humanistic, and spoke to people of Brahms' time in a way that no other piece before it had.
And it's—I don't know whether—it's important for a modern audience to hear that and understand how radical that was for the time. Because I mean, in the 21st century, change the language, you know, no big whoop. Like, well, right. You know, for something that had endured for centuries in one way, it was radical.
Very radical.
I mean, I think it was probably like when Mozart would write operas in German, right?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed
yep.
to what Italian was the, yeah.
Right.
I think it's important to note that all you are, although you are departing the UK academic community, you are still the music director of the Lexington Singers,
yes.
And so people will still be able to see you in action at the podium with that ensemble.
Yes.
What has driven you to keep directing that group?
Well, the Lexington Singers now, gosh, you talk about a special group. That ensemble, and we're talking about 200 adults. And multi-generational, mm-hmm. right? Our youngest singer is probably, right now, is probably 19 or 20. And our oldest one would be well into their 80s. So
probably has been with the group since its founding.
Maybe so, or close. Close. We're in the 60-something year yeah. of the Lexington Singers, and I've been with them 28 of those years. But the Lexington Singers is such a special group. There's only been... Besides it being so large, such a large group and multi-generational, there have only been three directors in the history, in the 66-year history, actually 68-year history of the Lexington Singers, just three directors, mm-hmm. and I'm the third. So everyone who has directed the group has stayed for, 20 years.
Yeah.
And that's very, very rare with the community chorus in our country. It just doesn't happen. And the other thing that doesn't happen is you don't have 200 people in a community chorus, and you get to sing the most difficult and challenging and most important works of art in the Western canon.
And we've talked, I mean, the idea of a community chorus being around 68 years, having that kind of longevity, that itself is not is a rare occurrence yeah. as well, correct?
Yes. Yeah. I like to compare our chorus to the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, which is not an exact comparison because they're a church choir, basically, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. But we're large like that, and we aspire to the same level of artistic integrity and greatness that they do.
Well, and you've probably, through your tenure at Lexington Singers, not just at UK, but with Lexington Singers, I don't want to sound too ingratiating, but you have probably risen to the level of George Zaks, the former director of the Lexington Philharmonic, his presence in the community is being so recognizable.
Mm.
So I think that's, I don't say that to ingratiate myself to you. I think it's...
That is a wonderful compliment. Thank you, Tom.
Well, and having, I think having worked with him, you know him well, so.
George Zach was an amazing force in our community. He went way beyond just being a conductor of the Lexington Philharmonic Orchestra. He was a true community leader. In every sense.
Now, I do want to, since we're talking about orchestral conducting, you have had a chance to do that quite a bit. And I don't know what your experience was like before you came to UK with orchestral conducting, but what have you learned more about orchestral conducting since you've been here?
Absolutely. Every time I have the privilege, and it really is a privilege for any choral conductor to conduct an orchestra, every time I have the privilege of doing that, I learn a great deal, actually. So, it's first of all, a big shout out to John Nardalillo, the conductor of the UK Symphony Orchestra, for entrusting me with his orchestra for this concert, for this Brahms concert. He's basically given me the keys to the Cadillac mm-hmm. and asked me not to wreck it.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank my guest today, Dr. Jefferson Johnson, UK School of Music Director of Choral Activities, who is retiring after 33 years at the university. Thanks, Jeff, for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Listen to Open Studio every Friday during WUKY's Morning Edition and in the afternoon during All Things Considered. or listen to extended segments at the Open Studio Podcast, available at wuky.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Do you have an idea for an Open Studio segment? We're always on the lookout for news and events in Central Kentucky's arts and cultural community. Email us at openstudiowuky@gmail.com or visit our Facebook page, keywords Open Studio on WUKY. Your idea may make it on the air. I'm Tom Musgrave. Thanks for listening to Open Studio on WUKY.